From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's second forum hour, veteran feminist and Bay Area journalist Peggy Ornstein will be joining us to talk about her quest to be a mother and the challenges faced by women caught between the desire to be unencumbered and the longing to give birth, as well as her personal experiences and research on fertility and infertility. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Bay Area journalist and feminist Peggy Ornstein went through what can only be described as a major ordeal or perhaps a saga in trying to get pregnant and seeking to be a mother. She calls her memoir Waiting for Daisy, a tale of two continents, three religions, five infertility doctors, an Oscar, an atomic bomb, and a romantic night, and one woman's quest to become a mother. A contributor to New York Times Magazine, she's also the author of Schoolgirls, Young Women, Self-Esteem, and the Confidence Gap, and Flux, Women on Sex, Work, Love, Kids, and Life in a Half-Changed World. Her work has appeared in the L.A. Times, Elle, Vogue, Mother Jones, Salon, and The New Yorker, and she joins us for Forum Second Hour, and good to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
Well, I mentioned that you're a feminist, and indeed you mentioned that in the book, and the book takes up some very big issues, if I may say so. I mean, obviously, fertility, we'll talk about that, infertility and all the new technology and so forth. But as far as feminism goes, I was struck by your candor on a couple of notes, and I want to just get right into this with you. The idea that, well, first of all, the ambivalence about having a child, particularly when you've staked out a career, as you did as a journalist, or any kind of career, and especially seeing some of your friends who have children turn into, what do you describe them as, like invasion of the body
odd
snatchers?
People.
Yeah, after they have children. But also that whole notion about being pro-choice and having these, I guess in Japanese it'd be water babies, or having feeling this life inside you that you don't want to call life because, you know, it might have to be extinguished by an abortion, and yet it feels like life.
Right. Well, yeah, that's sort of getting into the middle of the story. This is a very personal book, and at one point I find out that I'm pregnant in Japan and have a miscarriage there, and it turns out that they have a ritual to perform when you've had a miscarriage or an abortion. You can make an offering to this bodhisattva called Jizo, and there's temples in Japan that have these little statues with red crocheted bonnets that women usually have made, and flowers and sometimes candy or toys that are offerings to Jizo to help guide the miscarried or aborted fetus, which in Japanese is called Mizuko. We don't have a word for that. It's called Mizuko, which is water child, back to the primordial waters and then back into the life it will eventually have. And so I decided to try to, after my miscarriage, do this and kind of set out, bought a little Hello Kitty plush ball and a little Anpan Man, which is a superhero made out of sweet bean field, whose head is made out of a pastry, basically, superhero pastry. And I went off to find a Jizo temple where I could make this offering. And it was really, it didn't fix everything, but it was immensely comforting. But I also felt like I had to work through, and I think this is part of the taboo around miscarriage, around talking about it, the idea that we project personhood onto the pregnancy or the fetus when we're going to have a baby. And yet as a person, a woman who is adamantly pro-choice, I don't believe that life begins at conception, and having to reconcile that and feel and try to figure out what it meant to feel this tremendous loss of this potential child while also being pro-choice was difficult.
Yeah, and that's what I was getting at, I guess, in terms of sexual politics that comes across in your book. And also, as I mentioned earlier, the ambivalence about even having a child or the choice of having a child. And perhaps I'm reminded of something that I was told once that Richard Ford, the novelist, told some young aspiring writers that if they really wanted to be writers, they should not have children. And local writer Herb Gold said that didn't keep Tolstoy from it's a good line, I always thought. But it does sort of impinge on that whole idea of I'm an independent woman, you know, I want to follow this career. And you saw these friends of yours who had children, I mean, before you actually made the decision to have a child, seemingly swallowed up by their motherhood and by the life of being a mother.
Yeah, well, I had a lot of things going on. I mean, it wasn't, it's, I don't like to put it as just a career children choice, because there was a lot of else going on in my life. I was enjoying my marriage. I was enjoying my friends. We were traveling around the world. We were having a great life. And I didn't feel that I necessarily wanted to have kids. I didn't see that that life was so exciting or so interesting to me. I was also 28 years old. And then time went on, and we didn't talk about it as much as we should have either. I think that's one of my regrets in retrospect, was not talking about it enough with my husband. And we went on and on and on like that. And finally, Stephen, my husband's father, died. And we were on an airplane, 30,000 feet or whatever it is up above Fresno. And he said, I feel like we're not participating in the life cycle. We'd had a lot of people die that year. It had been a really bad year.
One of your close friends died.
Friend died. Others had died of AIDS or cancer. Stephen's dad died. And he just said, where there's death, there should be life. And it was almost like just tipping scales in my heart. I just sort of went, oh, okay.
And you also had a cancer diagnosis.
And 6 weeks later, I was diagnosed with breast cancer.
Funny moment. I mean, sad moment, tragic moment, battling cancer. Funny when you said, I eat organic broccoli. How can I get
right.
cancer? If again that connection exists or something. But boy, did you go through hell! I mean, just your first miscarriage. I have this image of you in Hawaii, literally puking like crazy because that's what you were doing most of the time. And then you take us on this journey, this odyssey of yours, and we meet an old boyfriend of yours who has 15 kids. By the way, is this woman with 69 kids? Is that for real?
Yeah. In Waiting for Daisy, I there's a lot of sort of side stories and shadow stories, and it's all about choices and who one might have been, if you'd gone this way or that way. And one thing,
but there is a recurrent motif: women disappear so often when they have babies.
Well, I one of my best friends, my first true love from high school, became a very Orthodox Jew, and he and his wife have 15 children. No multiples, and yes, she gave birth to all of them. And I go down and spend a few days with their family to see what my life might have been like it was right after my first miscarriage. I was going down there to give a talk, and I was visiting them. And I kind of thought maybe if I spent some time with somebody with 15 kids, I wouldn't feel so bad about not having any. But during the course of my research later, I found that the world record, was it 69? 69, was that?
Yeah, that was the world record of that woman. Yeah.
Right, who goes down in history.
Nameless.
Nameless, yeah, which she probably didn't know her own name by the time she was done with 69 kids.
But you describe, after these side trips and everything, what you call or characterize as the descent into the world of infertility. It's a descent. It's sort of like, Dantean almost in some ways, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose it is. It's circular. Yeah. There's a big difference between thinking you might not want to have kids and being told that you can't have kids. And I think that shifts your perspective enormously. And then it's this slow thing. Before I started this, I really never would have imagined. I always say that this book is about doing all the things you swore you'd never do to get the thing you didn't even know you wanted. And I just slowly, incrementally, my husband and I, went down this path. And, you walk into the infertility doctor's office and you're already vulnerable, and, it's decorated in dusty pink and blue, and there's the binders bursting with Christmas cards and birth announcements, and there's the poster on the wall with all of the names of all the children the doctor has helped make, and you're looking around at this, and you've had a miscarriage, and you've been trying to get pregnant for a couple years, and there you are. You're sold. I mean, it's that easy.
Talking to Peggy Orenstein, her new book is Waiting for Daisy. It's also something that you became obsessed with. I mean, this is a word that I think can be used pretty freely here, and the notion that somehow you as a person were reduced to whether or not you could produce a child.
Yeah, that was just, this is a story of many things. It's a story of a marriage and what happened to it during this time. And also, again, I was just very surprised. Here I was, a person who didn't particularly want to have children. And several chapters later, there's a point where actually, because of my previous book, Flux, Oprah calls you know, the thing that we all want to happen as writers, the thing that we're waiting for, the fairy godmother comes down and taps me on the head, to have me on to talk about, to sort of defend women who don't have kids in their 40, by the time they're 40. And I just thought, I knew what I was supposed to say, but I just couldn't do it because I felt like I'd become sort of, you know, everything, I think it's so easy, and this is the, I think, the larger lesson of the book. No matter whether it's infertility or whatever the thing is that you think you don't have in your life, to let that become the thing that defines you instead of all that you've built and all that you've done and all that you are.
We should mention, too, that you had special circumstances. First of all, you had one ovary, and your husband had a low sperm count. I mean, I don't mean to make these things public here. I mean,
well, they are in the book, yeah, but yeah, when you sort of say I'm sitting across from me, it's a little embarrassing.
Thinking
yeah.
about your mucus, but we don't want to go there. But there are these distinctions, I mean, that seem to be of concern, and your age, and yeah. The doctor suggested pretty early on donor eggs, and I was interested in your response was to think of The Handmaid's Tale and
yeah.
never will I do this. But
and there I was doing it.
And
right?
there you were doing
yeah.
it again. Plus, a young woman comes into your life, and that's quite a side story. A young woman who wants to be involved in the process, who admires your books and actually offers to donate.
Yeah, Jess. Jess wrote to me when she was 15, and she'd read Schoolgirls, and we... And usually girls would write to me once or twice, and that would be the end of that. But she kept writing, so I kept writing. And, you know, 6 or 7 years went by, and we were still emailing several times a day and very close. And she offered to be an egg donor for us. And, you know, we first said, no, we would never do that. But over time, we talked about it, and we thought about it, and we brought her out with no expectations or strings attached. And, you know, then I'm standing in the airport corridor looking at this young woman coming towards me thinking, you know, do I want her to be the mother of my child? And it was, you know, it was an amazing thing to go through.
But you did make quite a bond between the two of you.
Which is still yeah. ongoing. Jess and I still email constantly and are very close friends.
And you almost adopted a baby. Two babies, one baby, no baby. I mean, you're in a kind of bind where it wasn't clear whether there was a young Japanese baby that was made available to you. And talk about, you became attached to him.
Yeah, well, we were offered, it was sort of out of the blue through connections in Japan. 5 days before this little boy was born, we were called and our friend said, do you want a baby? There's going to be a baby and he needs a home. And we sort of said, well, okay. Yeah. That's what we'll do. And usually it takes, you know, 4 to 6 months to do the paperwork for international adoption. And I think we got through it in about 3 weeks with the help of a lot of wonderful people. And we bought our plane tickets and we were all set to go and, you know, meet the baby and try to figure this out. And then we hit this wall of this one woman who was at the
Bernice,
time.
Bernice,
yeah, in charge of all adoption out of San Francisco, you know, the San Francisco Inner Bay Area. And for some reason, which seemed to have to do with her confusing Japan and Cambodia, she wasn't allowing Japanese adoptions to go through. And it wasn't clear whether we would be able to get the baby home, you know, in weeks, in months, in years, ever at all. And we went over there not knowing if that was going to be the case and spent time with him and not knowing any, you know, knowing nothing about babies, knowing, you know, not why they cry, nothing. And they were handed us the baby and said, take him away. And we took him for 5 days and poor thing was, you know, screaming because what did we know? And but by the end, I loved him. And I guess through that love, sort of, we came to realize that it wasn't fair for us not knowing if we would ever be able to take him home to let him sit there and wait and wait and wait and wait for parents. And so we had to let him go, and that was really hard.
It's quite a story. Again, the book is Waiting for Daisy. It's Peggy Orenstein's story, and you might have guessed the ending because it's in the title, but still a gripping story, and I think people have said it reads like a novel, and I think that's true. But you've done a lot of research, as is your wont, as a journalist, and discovered there are about 13,000 people using donor eggs each year, mm-hmm. we find out from your book, but over 1.7 billion fertility treatments.
Million,
fertility treatments, which is an astonishing number.
Well, yeah, it's a $3 billion a year industry. I think that's where the billion was coming from. It's huge, and it has tripled, I think, in the last 10 years. So it's a growing industry, and it's an industry that...
growing in technology, too.
Growing in technology, growing in size, self-regulated, and very much, you know, a business as well as a medical practice. And we found when we did the donor egg cycle with Jess, it kind of fell apart in the lab, and that was when we sort of hit another, another situation where they had screwed up basically. And so, in addition to feeling, you know, barren at that point, I that was supposed to be our last best chance, and I felt so betrayed. And so we go through a lot around that and how they handled that and how we handled that and what, you know, what happened between us. Boy, I'm sounding like this is so depressing, and it's really actually a funny book as well.
Well, it is funny. I mean, yeah. But you did go through a lot, and it was costly. And in fact, I've opened the book here to this passage that you're talking about, and you say, and I think this is like illumination time, but I finally got it. These guys may have been doctors, but they were also salesmen. I may have been a patient, but I was also a consumer. I was undergoing a procedure, but I was also making a deal, and they were making a buck.
Yeah, that's absolutely so.
Kind of says it. And you did have all kinds of medical opinions and medical input here. Mm-hmm. Chinese doctors and Japanese doctors and, you know, doctors of all varieties and I suppose allopathic, non-allopathic, traditional, non-traditional. Found yourself standing next to Michael Chabon, whose wife, Violet Waldman, calls him the Sperminator. I hadn't known that. This would presumably bring some fertile effect on you?
Yeah, they're probably listening. Michael, I had met Violet a few months earlier, and at that time, I felt like a lot of the women, you know, I was so, at that time, if anybody asked me how I was, you know, there was a risk that I would actually tell them. And so I kept to myself a lot.
Including to my husband,
yeah. And I think I tended to gravitate towards other women who had experienced some loss, which they had. And we became friends, and she was pregnant with their fourth child. And we went to Yom Kippur services together, and she said, and at the place we went, they when they did the blessings for the Torah, instead of having just one person come up, they did it by concept. So they'd say, everybody who worked for peace this year, you know, crowd in the aisles and bless. And they did anybody who is creating or wants to create life in the next year. And a Violet leaned over and said, come up with us and stand next to Michael. I call him the Sperminator. And he put his prayer shawl up above us, and Violet and I held hands behind his back, and I touched the person in front of me who was touching the person in front of them, who was touching the person in front of them, to the person who was touching the Torah, and we blessed the Torah. And gee, if I tell you what happened next,
well,
I've given
no,
away the end.
We don't give
so
away.
Well, but
we
that's a pretty. That's a that was a that was a very emotional and I guess spiritual experience. And I was surprised in Waiting for Daisy how much religion did come up, because I'm not a particularly devout person, and yet there it is. It's in the beginning of the book. It's in the end of the book. There's Buddhism. There's, you know, there's a key pivotal scene at Glide, and you know, it was all over the place.
It certainly plays a role.
Yeah.
But the central, I mean, there are a number of central themes here. I thought one of the main ones is just the failure that one feels with infertility.
Yeah.
I mean, it's overwhelming.
I think that was really unexpected for me, that really primal sense of being defective. I mean, I felt very much like my body was a lemon. And then I think that that's exacerbated right now by a culture that is blaming women for, you know, quote, waiting too long. So it's very easy, I think, and I can't speak to how men feel, although I think that there's some similar dynamics, but nobody tells them that they've waited too long. But I think that impulse to blame ourselves is pretty universal and really hard to grapple with and unfair to ourselves.
Can I read a strong passage from your book, just to be brief?
Read
here.
Away.
We're talking about you're talking about religion a moment ago, and you say everything happens for a reason, somebody tells you. And you say, I bristled. That's not something I believe, not when women I love die leaving babies behind, not when children are starving, when adults are tortured, nor do I like its corollary, God only gives you what you can handle. If so, God is a sadist. Sounds very heretical. I refuse to view life through such a simplistic, superstitious lens, whether it's held up by religion or by New Age. I did not get cancer because I held in anger. My infertility was not a result of my ambivalence about motherhood, nor did I ultimately get pregnant because I was trying to adopt. It's a cruel myth that adoptive parents are subsequently more likely to conceive than other infertile couples. The rates for both are between 3 to 10%. In fact, stress, that boogeyman of modern maladies, may be less relevant to both cancer and infertility than previously believed. You're
You had to read that. God, now in a call-in show, Michael.
Well, you know, your anger is clear there, and it's anger again at that assumption that this is somehow your failure. You mentioned people like Bernie Siegel who say, "Well, you know, it must be your cancer," and that sort of thing. And that's an idea that's out there in religion and in New Age.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when I was diagnosed with cancer, I would go after anybody who tried to put that on me. And one of my friends is still trying to live down the fact that she asked me if I had a cancer, if I thought I had a cancer personality. And then I published that in the New York Times, so you know I got back at her. But I was never willing to accept that, and I would always attack that if I heard it with cancer. But with infertility, it was different. With infertility, I felt I had to really struggle with self blame throughout, and I think that that's a theme in the book is how I struggle with that. And that said, There was a combination of choices and fate that played in, and you know, both are true, but I think I overinflated the aspect of choices.
You also chose to fast on Yom Kippur and to be essentially observant about that holiday, which is tied to repentance and forgiveness and all of the things.
Well, I opened the book with that, actually, and that was sort of, you know, I think the hardest part of writing books is the first chapter. And the introduction, you know, if you write an introduction, the introduction, because you're, you know, you have to figure out how to bring people in and establish yourself as a character. And, you know, I've sat and watched people at Cody's or in other bookstores, and, you know, pick up a book, look at the first page, shrug and put it down. So that's, you know, the worst nightmares that you'd see somebody do that with your book. So watch it if you're in Cody's, because I am watching and I go there all the time. But
you'll be there Thursday night.
I'll be there Thursday night reading. Yeah. But I liken what I did. I'm sitting at the beginning in the synagogue in Yom Kippur, that same service actually, and there's a prayer called the Ashamnu that is a list of the sins that we may have committed over the past year that Jews always say several times during that holiday. And I kind of did my own little list of sins that I committed against myself and my marriage during the last 6 years of trying to have a child, you know, all involving obsession, you know, from drinking cough syrup to try to improve the, you know, flow of the stuff that helps you get pregnant to making my husband have soulless infertility sex to, you know, all the different things that we sort of went through in our marriage.
One of the things early on that you write about that I was struck by in terms of your own apprehensions about motherhood was you were afraid that in some ways you couldn't be the mother that your mother was to you. I mean, you know, playing games and sitting for long periods of time and being that attentive and loving and concerned and so forth. I think you got the answer to that question.
Well, it was both. It was two things. It was that my mother was, you know, she was really the 1950s, you know, Donna Reed kind of mom. And on one hand, I knew I could never be that because that just isn't who I am. But at the same time, it was too easy to say that I was just rejecting my mother as a mother, because she was also a great mother in many ways and romantic when she went off, you know, with my dad and played all these games. And so it was a double-edged thing.
Coming up on a break, we're going to give you, that is, listeners, a chance to talk with Peggy Orenstein. In fact, you can join us now. Please do. Toll-free, wherever you're listening to us, radio, internet, Sirius satellite, it's 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your calls. 866-733-6786. If you'd like to join the program, you can also do so by email. Email address, forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking to Peggy Orenstein. Her book is called Waiting for Daisy, and she's mentioned a couple of times her husband, Stephen Akazaki, who is a filmmaker, well-known here in the Bay Area, and man, she fell in love with on a postcard. That's, you'll have to find out about that by getting hold of the book. If you'd like to get a hold of us, you can do that now. And in fact, we welcome your phone calls. I'd particularly like to hear maybe from some women or men who have gone through some of these vicissitudes of trying to get pregnant and have struggled against the whole, well, sometimes rather vexing, and that's putting it mildly, formidable situation of trying to navigate through the world of drugs and infertility clinics and new technology and all of that. Peggy really has certainly told the story here. Some of you have stories, I know, and you can join us toll-free, 866-733-6786. 6786, or you can email us, and we welcome your emails as well. Our email address here is forum@kqed.org. A lot of ordeals, and certainly they don't all have happy endings, alas, but let's find out what our listeners have to say. Julie, you're first up. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a little nervous, long-time listener, first-time caller, and infertility is something that's really dear to me. I've actually gone through IUI treatments and IVF a couple of times, and it is, the most difficult experience I've ever had in my life. And I'm sitting here now with my one-year-old feeding him breakfast, so you know how it's turned out, but it hasn't been easy. And my question for Peggy is just dealing with family and friends. You know, it's such a hard thing because you're going through infertility, and many times you've got friends and family around you, you know, announcing pregnancies and baby showers, and while you have this silent struggle. And for me, it wasn't easy to come out to them. It wasn't easy to talk about it because I would just break down in tears, you know, every time I would go through another month, another cycle, and it wasn't successful. And I'm actually, the funny thing is I'm calling you, but I still haven't come out to some family and friends just because, you know, for the longest time, I didn't want to say anything. I didn't want to jinx my pregnancy. I've got my baby here now, but it's such a personal struggle, and I wondered if you had talked about it or how difficult it was or, you know, sort of how you dealt with your community around you.
Well, I guess that's why I said a little bit earlier that I got very isolated because if anybody asked me, how are you? I was afraid I would tell them. And it was just too long a saga. But, you know, I actually, my older brother and sister-in-law had gone through this before me, and I had watched them and watched what had happened to her. And she had been unable to do things like go to a baby name, my other niece's baby naming and things like that. And I worked really hard to stay close to my friends who were pregnant or having babies, baby showers, I don't know, but because I was afraid that if things didn't work out and I didn't end up being a parent, these were going to be the children in my life and I really wanted to be involved with them. But it's a really common thing for women who are having trouble having a baby to be unable to be around friends who have babies. And I think it's hard for others to understand that and who you tell and when you tell and why you tell, you know, that's just a really deeply personal thing and really difficult. Now I've chosen to tell the whole world. But
Julie, thank you for the call. Yeah, what about that? I mean, coming out, as it were, with all of these feelings. In fact, there are things you say, for example, that I thought to myself, I mean, things that...
too much information?
Well, no. But for example, there was one point where you talked about... stuff that you didn't disclose to your husband about caring or not caring with Kai, the baby we mentioned in Japan, although you do reveal that you revealed that to him. And so there are lots of, and you know, some of the feelings of shame and mortification we're talking about here, they're all out there.
And I'm not always so, you know, such a nice person in the book. Well, you know, when I was thinking about writing...
The back of the Vespa? No.
When I was thinking about writing this book, I was thinking of two different books, this one and another one that was personal but less intimate. And Stephen and I talked about it because obviously, I mean, as hard as it is for me to put myself out there in an honest way, you know, he is trusting me to put him out there. And I think that's a much bigger leap and a leap of faith and a gift that I, you know, that I didn't want to abuse. And we talked a lot about it and he had one condition, and that was if I wrote this book that I had to be absolutely honest. And that I could not sugarcoat anything about who I had been during this period, what we had gone through together, what had happened to our marriage. And, you know, to just keep, I kept my feet to the fire. And that was really hard.
It took a lot of courage.
I'm not the most emotionally honest person in real life. And it really...
you really are a woman of valor after
all. Yeah, no. But I really worked hard on that. And I think that it's what... I took away from this project was I think that that's what it's done for me. It's helped make me a more honest person.
It's also the honesty about the whole ordeal that you went through. And we should mention you had a molar pregnancy, and one in five people who have that actually find that they have cancer or that it leads to cancer. And so You write about
more
this.
Fun.
Well, this and your breast cancer. I mean, there are just so many things that cut so deeply in this book, and yet you're able to keep us on a narrative structure that makes us want to read more, which I think is almost what a novelist does.
Well, yeah, it was really, you know, I actually thought this book was going to be easy to write despite the subject matter because it was just about me and I didn't have to go out and report. I could write it in my house. You know, it was very exciting. But when you report, you interview somebody and you have your transcripts and your tapes and that's what you have. And when you're writing about yourself, you have, you know, the material is as infinite as your memory. And it's really hard to step back and carve out this character of you and this narrative structure. And I was having such a, for I'd say a year, I sat and played, you know, computer Boggle, basically, and fretted. And then Stephen, my husband, said, look, why don't you go back to your old therapist? And because she's trained to elicit a narrative of meaning. And just go for a few times with a tape recorder and have her interview you and see what happens. And that actually kickstarted me. That I typed those little transcripts out. Yeah, it was a great idea. And that's
it's
why
so
I
hard
them.
I've written about myself, and I find that either I'm self-lacerating to an extreme or I'm self-inflating to extremes, and they have to find that balance that really is not sugar-coated, as you said, or for that matter, vinegar-coated.
Right. And I think you also can, reveal things about yourself that you don't realize you're revealing when you, you know, what does that mean that those are the two ways that you present yourself? You know, that it's a really fascinating thing, and I found that my first-person work has not only, you know, when I've written for, about the Jizo, the miscarriage in Japan, that was originally in the New York Times, and I wrote about my breast cancer in the New York Times magazine also, and those have been the pieces that have elicited the most response, so they've really, the personal pieces have ended up being the most satisfying for me as a writer.
We get more calls. Ellen, morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, is that me? I'm on the phone?
If you're Ellen, you're too.
Yes. Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm actually just in my car driving and hearing you, and I just wanted to comment that I went through about six years of infertility and about miscarriages in that time, some later ones. And during that time, and I just completely relate to what you're saying, particularly about the business of the infertility. And what happened to me is I couldn't afford, I went did everything except in vitro or a donation because I could not afford that. And I was blessed. I have a 6-foot-tall, 15-year-old son, and that the last time I tried to get pregnant with some fertility drugs, and I said to myself, this is the last attempt. I can't go through this anymore. I got pregnant and actually had a child, a healthy, beautiful boy. So for me, it ended good, but the hell that I went through, I'm not supposed to say that word, but particularly in the business of the infertility world, was, and just with people and friends, and I got to the point where I could not relate to anyone that was pregnant, anyone that had children. And it took me even years afterwards to deal with women that had more than one child. I couldn't even deal with that. So it sort of consumed my life and my husband's life. And it took us many years to get to learn how to have sex. That wasn't, as you said, I don't remember the words you used, but
fertility sex.
Yeah. Fertility sex. Right. Do it right now.
I think you said soulless before
20 minutes, or legs up for an hour or whatever. So I just completely relate. And so just hearing this conversation just brings, you know, it brings it all back. And it makes me want to cry just for my blessing. And I'm assuming you, your book means you have a child or you're pregnant?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah. No, I have a 3.5-year-old.
Pardon me?
I have a 3.5-year-old daughter.
Oh, yeah. It makes me just, you know, but it also makes me cry for so many women that do not ever get to that and have that. So I just want to thank you for, I'm going to read your book, but it might be awfully painful to read.
Well, like she said, there's humor in there, too, and a lot of good spirit. And thank you, Ellen, for your call.
Thank you very much. And I think also, I think that it can, having that stuff resonate, I found that it resonating with readers, that it actually is helpful. And you brought up so many things that are so important. That idea of being consumed by it, the hit your sex life takes, but also what I'm hearing from you and what I really felt and was that I didn't want, and this was another thing when I was thinking about writing Waiting for Daisy, I thought, okay, so at the end of this, there's a baby, but that can't just be the happy ending and then we go on with our lives and la-di-da, everything's okay. Because I really felt that the means through which we got there and what we put ourselves through and what I put us through and what I put myself through did not did not justify the end, that I wish, if I have anything that I could go back and do over, I wish I had been able to go through that process differently. I don't know if it's possible, but to live the life that you have while you're trying to do this other thing is tremendously difficult. And I think that the ramifications from going through this, we have put our marriage back together. You have to put your life back together when it's all over.
Here's a sense for listeners of what we're talking about here. We keep talking about this ordeal. This is about three quarters of the way through. I considered I'd been through 6 months of Clomid, which is a drug that causes rage,
devil,
among other things. Yeah.
The devil Clomid.
Two rounds of IVF, three miscarriages, and a year of acupuncture. We'd spent over $40,000 trying to have what we now call the biogenic child. Each month I was convinced I was pregnant. Each month I was crushed when I wasn't. Each month I had to confront my ambivalence. Let's get some more callers. We got Barbara on from Indiana listening to us on Sirius. Barbara?
Yes.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because I went through this quite a long time, or longer ago than Peggy did. My children are now 25 and 22,
wow,
both adopted. We were trying to become pregnant in the 70s, and the late 70s in particular, before in vitro fertilization really was available. We got partway through the process and really very quickly reached the point where we said, this isn't worth it. We both felt like biological failures. So I really relate to that feeling of feeling that somehow there's something wrong with you if you can't produce a child. Also, your comment about when people would say, after we adopted, people would say to us, now you'll get pregnant, as if there was something not quite right about the child,
mm-hmm,
that we had. Which made me furious. I really couldn't hardly tolerate those. I guess my overall comment is, what I really learned from the whole experience was, it's really about becoming a family. And that's a completely individual decision. We were happy to adopt and blessed to adopt. I believe those children were born to be ours.
Mm-hmm.
But we had good friends who couldn't, and that was all right, too. That's really all I had to say. I'll hang up and take any comments you have off the air.
Thank you, Barbara.
That idea that your children were born to be yours, that's really a common theme among adoptive families or egg donor or sperm donor families, that this was the child that was that are happy, that this was how it was meant to be. And I had that experience, too, that there was a certain point where my regular doctor, not my fertility doctor, said, I'd had three miscarriages, and she said, nobody can tell you that you won't be able to get pregnant and have a baby, but nobody can tell you that you will. And you have to make a decision about how important it is to you to get pregnant versus how important it is to you to become a parent and when you hit that line. And I think that the caller really articulated that well.
Talking again to Peggy Ornstein, her book is Waiting for Daisy. You can join us toll-free, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org. Let me go to a couple of your emails. This is Noel, who writes, I don't understand why more people are not outraged at how the infertility industry preys upon people who want to have kids. Success rates are dismal, yet people spend so much money on treatments, it's criminal. As a child-free woman, I do feel badly for the sad journey that infertile people go through. If more would accept the child-free option, perhaps more people would be less tortured about the whole issue. If adoption were not so fraught with problems, would things be easier? I wish it would, but I'm afraid not. Another listener, Spencer, says, I wanted to comment on blaming women for waiting too long. I wouldn't blame a woman for waiting too long. However, I do think that we all make choices, and there are some physical ramifications to waiting until you're in your late 30s, early 40s to decide to get pregnant. And I have no idea how old the author is, but I think we do expect to have it all in modern America and ignore the very real physical requirements of certain life events, in particular pregnancy and child rearing, both of which are easier when you're young and strong versus older and slower.
I would say that certainly it's true that it's easier to get pregnant when we're younger. But the reasons why, women, it's not that we wait too long. I mean, there's all kinds of things that come into play, and there's all kinds of, part of, I think, what this book is about is the confusion and contradiction of being a woman right now. And one thing that I write about in Waiting for Daisy is this campaign that the reproductive endocrinologist had put up for a while, bus shelter ads, that showed a upside-down baby bottle shaped like an hourglass with the sands of time, like milk, running out. And the tagline was, women's fertility declines with age. You know, it was like you'd be walking to your bus stop to go to work with your morning coffee and ba-doom, you know, you'd see that. And I thought, well, you know, true enough, and yet are those same doctors then lobbying within their profession to change the way that the profession is run so that women to make it easier for women to get pregnant and have babies when they're younger? Because medicine, for instance, is one of those professions where it's really, really hard, where they're going to tell you when you go in, don't have a baby while you're an intern, don't have a baby while you're a resident. Well, that's the prime childbearing years. So are we throwing it back on women and blaming women for the very real obstacles that are structural, or are we looking at the structure?
We'll go to more of your calls. Laura, joining us from up in Forestville, is an in vitro nurse. Laura, is that right?
Well, I'm currently not an in vitro nurse, but I was in a large clinic in Atlanta for about 2.5 years. And I think the reason that reproductive endocrinologists try and get the information out there about declining ovarian function with age is because when you're in an in vitro fertilization clinic and someone comes in at the age of 40 and you test their blood and check their ovarian function and it's very diminished, they're shocked that this is the case and that one of their best options is egg donation. And they just, as long as anyone wants to be childbearing and is open to the idea of egg donation or open to the idea of adoption, that's okay. But the women need to know that after the age of 35, their ovarian function really significantly declines, and that affects their fertility.
Well, also, as you learn in Peggy's book, and as many people, of course, are well aware, the chances of having a Down syndrome baby or a baby that has problems with age also increase.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that the caller's right that it's important to understand how fertility works. You know, that was one thing when in Waiting for Daisy, Stephen and I go into the doctor's office and we're in this office that I said earlier has all the, you know, the binders and the cards and the babies on the wall and all this. And then the doctor pulls out a chart that shows how fertility declines with age. And Stephen looks at it it sort of goes down. And at 35, it kind of goes boom. And it's like, it's off a cliff. And he just looks at me and says, did you know this? He couldn't believe it. And I kind of did, but I was willing to, I was certainly willing to take that chance. And 2/3 of women do get pregnant just fine at 35. And so then, you know, by the time you've gone through all that and then they say that you have a 10, you know, they told us, well, he told us we had a 10%, he calculated we had a 10% chance of getting pregnant on our own. To answer a question from an earlier caller, then when they tell you that you have a 30% chance of getting pregnant via IVF, that statistic suddenly sounds pretty good. You don't think I have a 70% chance of not getting pregnant.
And we thank the caller. We'll go to more of your calls. We'll go to Jackson, Florida. Paul, good morning.
How you doing?
Hi.
It's great conversation. My wife and I just finished about 4 years of this ordeal, and we went through in vitro, and it was pretty much our last shot too. But I hear all this, and I just remember us going through all this. And in fact, our child is due in about a month, and our first and probably only child this way. But
congratulations!
I appreciate it. We kept it light. I had to give my wife a shot every morning, and, you know, we'd always say, hey, I love you, here's the shot. And or when we tried to have a child, we were traveling, oh, if we have a child, if it's conceived here, we're going to call her this or call her that. But, you know, with all the bad news we were getting, that was the only thing that really kept us going was we knew some way or another we were going to have a child. And we did. And we will.
Well, again, our congratulations. And, Paul, thanks for calling in this morning.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. Well, let's hear next from Ruhi. Morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I've been listening to so many callers who've been through and who've had a successful pregnancy. I'm someone who's still struggling with this. I mean, I've had 2 miscarriages in the previous year. And
I'm sorry.
It's really been tough. And I'm really scared of getting pregnant the third time. And when I heard Peggy saying how she regrets not speaking much about this to her husband, that's one thing that I've not been doing.
Yeah, well,
It's just such a silent struggle, but I just don't know how to confront him. I mean, yeah, I'm just amazed with all these things.
Peggy, some words of advice and wisdom?
I think it is hard. I think it's hard as a woman. It's your body. And I think that early pregnancy can seem more abstract for men. So we do go through it differently. And I really, in Waiting for Daisy, you know, my first miscarriage, I was pretty philosophical, even the second one. But the third one really knocked me flat. I mean, I just felt, you know, pretty much fell to my knees in the hospital where I had the where they told me and started to cry, and I don't, you know, going through it again, putting yourself out there to go through it again, it takes a lot of courage. It's a hard thing to keep going through, and I think it is that constant decision of do you want to go through it, and the importance to you personally of getting pregnant versus becoming a parent, and I don't know what sorts of, you know, tests you've been through with your doctor and that kind of thing. But most people, after having a couple of miscarriages, will go on to successfully have a baby.
Good luck to you, Ruhi, and thank you for the call. Here's Willy, another listener, who writes, what are things that a friend with kids can do for someone who's been trying unsuccessfully to have a baby? What should we avoid saying or doing?
I think that you have to... I don't know if I'm the expert on this. You know, for me, I felt that friends who let me lead the conversation, that was helpful. I didn't want people asking me about it all the time. And I mean, one of the ironies of Waiting for Daisy was that I say that I didn't want to be defined by motherhood, and then I became self-defined by not being able to have a mother, and then I didn't want to be defined by infertility, and now I've written a book that pretty much makes me the go-to gal. But I didn't want to be asked about it that much. But if I wanted to talk about it, I appreciated a listening ear and a shoulder to cry on.
And we'll go to more of your calls. Let's go next to Jean. Thanks for waiting, Jean. You're on forum.
Sure. My niece by marriage, I hadn't seen her in maybe part of a year, and they called up and said, guess what, we had twins. And I almost dropped the phone. Didn't know she was pregnant. And as it turned out, they had kept their pregnancy secret. And, you know, my husband was almost offended, but not quite, but just shocked. And I thought, you know, fine, if she wanted to do that, if they wanted to keep a secret, if the family wanted to keep a secret, that's fine with me. And when I saw them, I was so happy for them, and am still today, and I have no problems with their keeping it secret, and especially your program and this book you're talking about. I want to thank you for bringing these issues up. I'm happy they've had children. I have no problem with them keeping it secret. I've mentioned it to only a few people. Some were shocked, and a couple were offended, and I think it was fine. You know, they did what they had to do, and they've got two beautiful daughters, and I just have no problem at all with any of this, and I'm really thankful that you're talking about these issues and the issues of privacy and the right to privacy, and I want to thank you.
Thank you for that, Jean. Appreciate that. And something else to bring into the mix here in a significant way, a listener who writes, I just wanted to comment that no one talks about men waiting. Many men I dated wanted to wait to have a family, and the man I married wanted to wait. So we waited until he was ready, and then it was too late for us. Everyone blames the woman for waiting, but frequently it's the man.
Yeah, I think that that's true. That's what I was saying. It's very complicated. It's, you know, this the waiting business is portrayed in this oversimplified way. And I wanted to say to the previous caller, I think it's really hard when you've gone through a lot to believe that your pregnancy is going to work. And I would joke, and I, you know, with friends that I won't believe the pregnancy is viable until the child graduates college. You know, I mean, it's a very hard thing, and I think it's very isolating, and I was very isolated. I think women who go through this tend to be, and that's partly why I wrote Waiting for Daisy, so they could read a book and and feel less. I mean, all my books really have come from that impulse of breaking taboos and starting conversations and continuing conversations in an honest way between and among women.
Joyce joins us from Marin. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, yes. Thank you. Your talk and your book is disturbing and inspiring at the same time.
Thanks.
I've been through a lot, meaning 2 abortions and 4 miscarriages. Ended up having my first child at 42, and then a second child with a surrogate at 52.
Wow.
And, you know, I've been wanting to write about this. And my husband left when I was 52, and I became a single parent and the whole thing. And so now my children are 13 and 24, and I, being a writer and a professor of human development, really have taken this. This has been my whole life, and I really want to write about it, and I have been writing about it over the years, but I'm very concerned about my children and their age and the exposure. I've talked to them about it. I do speak to my husband now.
Joyce, forgive me. We're coming up at the end. Maybe we can get a quick response from Peggy about making this public where your children are concerned.
Well, this is my story, and it ends. Daisy isn't in the book, so I feel that this is my story and my right to tell it. And when she, you know, when she starts, then it becomes her story.
Joyce, write it would be my advice.
Mine
and then,
too.
And then you'll see. Thank you for the call, and thank you, Peggy Orenstein. Peggy Orenstein will be at Cody's Thursday, at Kepler's on Friday. Next week, a whole battery of places, Capitola and Santa Cruz on Tuesday, Stacy's Wednesday at noon, Thursday at Rakestraw in Danville, and Friday at A Good Place for Books in Montclair, Book Passage Saturday at 2 o'clock. Again, the book is Waiting for Daisy. Thank you for being with us on Forum. I want to thank our producers, Robin Genetasio-Mall, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.